Okay, Shuli, you can start whenever you're ready
Okay,
to
you
start.
want to do a hello or not?
Yeah, well, not hello for Tisha B'Av. I still hope it finds it meaningful. Everybody's doing well. And like we were discussing, Tisha B'Av is a very powerful, meaningful day. And like I say, it's sort of the origins of Torah in Motion are really in Tisha B'Av, the program. And it's there's a lot to learn. And especially this year, I think we all agree that the divisions we have to reconcile and learn how to talk to people, especially who we don't agree with. And we should hope that we should learn the message of Tisha B'Av and turn it into, like the Navi Zakaria says, into a day of rejoicing and hopefully be a day of inspiration for many of us. And want to thank Shuli for kicking off the day. It's 6 p.m. in Israel and 11 here. Bakasha Shuli, it's all
Okay,
yours.
thank you so much. So I'm gonna share my screen and I'll just give a second of introduction before we get to what we're actually talking about here. So here in Israel, I know not in Toronto, but I know we have a lot of Israelis who are online with us now. And here in Israel, 6 p.m., Tisha B'Av afternoon. One of the things that's fascinating about Tisha B'Av is it's not like other fasts. We're going to accept Yom Kippur from that. But the other fasts that are about Churban Bayit, Tisha B'Av, we don't say Tachanun. We don't say Avinu Malkeinu. The Shulchan Aruch says it's a moed, it's a chag. And there are all kinds of interesting customs that have arisen in the end of the day on Tisha B'Av, where people clean their house, where women even wash their hair, where there's this like feeling of chagigiyot, of a holiday. And part of the reason for that is that we have legends that talk about how Mashiach is born on Tisha B'Av, that in the depths of destruction is the beginnings of Geula, is the beginnings of redemption. And that sort of ties into what our theme is today. What I'm going to talk about is we towards the end, we are going to get to Churban. It is, after all, Tisha B'Av. But the first, I would say, two-thirds of what I'm going to talk about is understanding what we've lost, meaning understanding what life was like in the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, in the heyday of Second Temple Jerusalem. And that's really going to be the first two-thirds of this talk today. So anybody who has questions, please, please, please put them in the chat. I will leave a few minutes at the end to address them. But we are going to talk about the heyday of the time period of Second Temple Jerusalem and then how it all fell apart. What time period are we talking about? We're talking about the last 100 years of the Second Temple period, meaning give or take 30 before the Common Era to 70 of the Common Era. Why those dates? Because that's from the time of Herod, more or less, right? Herod starts a few years earlier, from when Herod rebuilds the Beit HaMikdash, right? Beit HaMikdash, let's call it 3.0, because we have the earlier versions of Shivat Zion, of the return to Zion, and of the Hasmoneans, but this is the largest, most impressive. Okay, it's also the time that Jerusalem grows. Jerusalem becomes its largest that it's going to be until the 19th century, right? The end of Second Temple times. That's the greatest Jerusalem of all. Yes, Rabbi Kelvin just put the sources in the chat if people want sources. We're going to have a few as we go on. So Jerusalem is very large, very beautiful, very impressive. We're not talking about its morality yet. We'll get to that towards the end. But first, we want to talk about the incredible beauty and power of this time period, and of Jerusalem itself, and how it becomes really an attraction. Not just Jews, but people come from all over the world to see Jerusalem, to see the temple. It becomes one of the wonders of the world. So we'll move along from this picture, which I think is just a gorgeous photograph. It almost looks as if like it's a model of the city, but it's an actual photograph. Avram Gracier is the photographer, and you can see Ir David here in the foreground and going up towards the Temple Mount, Southern Wall, excavations. We're going to get to all those places. Okay, let's get started. So our first stop on this journey is understanding Aliyah LaRegel, right? Literally a journey, right? We have the commandment that you have to come to the temple. Torah talks about coming three times a year. In First Temple times, okay, everybody lived around, not around Jerusalem, but lived in the land of Israel. Okay? We don't have a diaspora yet in First Temple times, unless you want to call the other side of the Jordan a diaspora. And so the concept that Jews could come three times a year is not impossible. Perhaps not everybody did it, but it's not impossible to imagine that you could come from the Galilee, a 2-3 day journey, that you could do that 3 times a year. Okay? By the time we get to Second Temple times, and we have this fascinating phenomenon of the diaspora, right? Jews living, as you can see in the map, and this is only a partial map. Okay, we have Jews all the way in Rome, in the area of Greece, of course, in Asia Minor up here, in Egypt, and what the map leaves out is the whole area of Babylonia. Coming to Jerusalem is a much more complicated story. And it's clear that not everyone, and perhaps not most people, came to Jerusalem 3 times a year. If you think about Pesach Sheni, right, the people who don't have to bring their Korban Pesach, that are allowed to come later, a month later, because they are b'derech rechoka, they are far away. How does the Mishnah define derech rechoka? Me'am Modi'in v'amala, from Modi'in, which today is not even 45 minutes drive from Jerusalem. Okay. In those days, maybe a half a day walk, a little bit more. And if those people are too far away, imagine the people in Babylonia, the people in Antioch, the people in Alexandria, that it would take them a couple of weeks to get here. So you have to think about Aliyah LaRegel sort of like we would compare it in the Muslim world today to the Hajj, right? The trip that you have to make to Mecca. Every good Muslim is supposed to make that trip at least once in his or her life. Okay. Did they make it more? Perhaps, but we don't expect everyone to do it every year, okay? But the ones who set out and who come, okay, this is a major journey. And that's why the beginning of Aliyah LaRegel season, right, pilgrimage season, we have rules about what the Sanhedrin is supposed to do. Now, what's the beginning of the season? Pesach, right? Pesach is the first holiday. Pesach is really the beginning of the year. Okay, we talk about Tishrei, but Pesach is really the beginning of the year, certainly in terms of pilgrimage to the Mikdash. And so a month before Pesach, or really a month and a half before Pesach, here we have the Mishnah in Shkalim, the very first Mishnah. On the first of Adar, they make a public announcement about the shekels and concerning kilayim. Okay, kilayim is about planting fruits. We're not so concerned about that right now, but the shkalim, meaning the half a shekel, we'll talk about that in a second. On the 15th of Adar, so when we think of the 15th of Adar, we think of Shushan Purim, the Mishnah does too. They read the Megillah in walled cities, but what else do we have here? They fix the roads and the streets and the ritual baths, and they perform all public duties, and they mark the graves, and messengers go forth also concerning kilayim. We have to get the roads ready. We're going to have this mass journey of people traveling to Jerusalem, and so the roads have to be in proper shape. But even more so, what about the mikvaot, the ritual baths? Hey, we're going to talk in a few minutes about who is allowed up on Har HaBayit, who is allowed to go up on the Temple Mount. But one of the preconditions is you have to go to the mikvah. Now, we know, and we're going to see this in a minute, that there were mikvahot all around the Temple Mount. More and more are being discovered as they do more excavations in the Kotel tunnels. We're finding so many mikvahot of all shapes and sizes, but we know that there are people who chose to go to the mikvah before they came to Jerusalem, okay? And there are a few reasons for that, okay? Before we get to the reasons, just take a look at this picture on the top. This is one of my favorite places. It's about a 10-minute walk from my house. This is the very beautiful mikvah on Derech Ha'avot, on the path of the patriarchs, right outside Alon Shvut of today, part of the ancient road that went from Beersheba to Hebron to Beit Lechem, to Jerusalem. Okay, we are on that ancient road, and this is really, up until now, the nicest mikvah that's ever been found in the land of Israel, because it has this beautiful entrance and exit, right? It's a lot of space. It's a very, very large mikvah. Ancient mikvahot are not so big. This happens to be very big. Why make it so big with an entrance and exit? So that people could come in and go out and not have to worry the tahor, the pure, to touch those who did not yet go in, the impure, which gives us a sense that this is a well-trafficked mikvah. This mikvah is found on the side of the road. It's not found near any settlements. It's not near any yeshuv in the ancient times. Today, it's near Alon Shvut, between Alon Shvut and Rosh Tzurim. But in ancient times, there was no community right there. And that leads us to believe that this was a mikvah that was for travelers. Now, why would you go to the mikvah on the road instead of waiting till you got to Jerusalem? Two reasons. Number one, right, why do you fill up at the gas station outside the city? It's less crowded. Maybe it's a little bit cheaper. It's just simpler to do it on the road. But number two is a halachic reason, right? When you go to the mikvah, you are pure, but in certain cases, you're only partially pure. There are certain types of tum'ah that require not just immersing in the mikvah, but what's called ha'arev shemesh. You have to wait till the sun sets. And when the sun sets, your purity kicks in. You've done everything you need to do. But in the evening, that's when you become pure. So here I am. I'm making my way to Jerusalem on Erev Chag. I see this mikvah. It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I go to the mikvah. I continue on my journey. We're about a half a day's journey from Jerusalem at this point. I get to Jerusalem. The sun is setting. Beautiful. I'm now tahor. I can now eat from the korbanot that I'm going to bring from my kodshim kalim. Okay. So that's a halachic reason to have this mikvah on the road. Okay. The other thing we hear in the Mishnah here is the machatzit hashekel, right? They make a public announcement about the shekel. We'll talk about the graves in a second. Sorry, I forgot the graves, but we'll talk about the shekel. Let's say you don't come. All right, you don't go to Jerusalem because it's too hard, it's too far, this year you couldn't make it, whatever reason. The Torah takes care of you and says, even if you're not coming to Jerusalem, you have a part in the avodah. You have a part in the sacrifices that are done in the Mikdash, because every Jewish male has to give a tax, has to give a half shekel tax to the Mikdash. From that half shekel, we buy the communal korbanot, right? Now you can't just give a half shekel from any coin. The Gemara, the Mishnah talks about, shekel, all the shekelim that the rabbis talk about is shekel tzori, a shekel that's made, that's minted at the mint in Tyre, right? Tyre in Lebanon was considered to have a particularly good mint. This is an enlargement of a half shekel coin. And this was the kind of coin that you had to give. It was a specific kind of coin. Okay, graves. In the olden days, most people, and I will include most of the people in this esteemed group, including myself, were not rich. And you did not have the opportunity to have a family grave, right? We see those beautiful family graves like Yad Avshalom, right, for example. But most people didn't have that, right? Most people were buried in what we would call today Potter's Field, right? They just dug a hole for them somewhere and they were buried. If they were lucky, they had some kind of a marker. Often there was not a marker. Often graves were on the sides of the road because you didn't want them in the community itself, and they didn't have a marker. So you are inadvertently going to become impure by coming in contact with these graves. And so we want to mark the graves. We want to make sure that everybody knows that they're there. By the way, we have a very ancient Jewish custom of putting stones on graves. Ask three rabbis why you do that. You'll get three different answers. We don't really know why we do it. And some people think that we do this because it's marking the graves. It's being able for us to see, oh, here's a grave. Steer clear of that. I want to stay tahor. Rabbi Kelman might disagree. I don't know. I'm going to let him. He can rebut later. Okay, moving along. You made it, right? You did your aliyah l'regel. You came. You went to the mikvah. Now that you're here, where are you going to go? What are you going to do? Your first stop is going to be the large pool at the bottom of Jerusalem, right? Today in the city of David, called the Brichat HaShiloch, the Shiloch Pool. Very, very large pool today. This is the picture on the left here. Today in this picture, you can only see a little bit of it. But in the last couple months, literally like the last 2 months, the city of David has managed to gain ownership of the whole area from the Greek Orthodox Church. And now they're starting to excavate it. So the whole pool is going to be exposed. This is a very, very large mikvah. It was also a meeting place. It was also a gathering place. This is where people heard the news. This is where people, found matches for their daughters. This is where they started their journey. And remember, Aliyah L'Regel is a very social event. It's not only about your korbanot. It's not only about your encounter with God. Of course, those things are important, but it's very social. Jews are coming from all over the world. Okay? And so after you've had your meeting point at the Shiloh, you start ascending on the road. Now, this main road, which is called the Pilgrim's Road, okay, this is just now being excavated in the city of David. Today, most of it is still underground, but you can see a lot of it. You can't go on the whole thing. You can actually walk through the sewers underneath the street the entire length of the road up till Robinson's Arch. But the street itself, you can only go part of the way. But this is a great picture of it. And it's actually very, very smart in terms of engineering. It's a steep incline. Anybody who's ever had to walk from the bottom of the Shiloh up towards the Kotel, it's a nice steep walk. Okay. And what they did to make this much easier is they created a street with steps so that you had these broad steps with spaces in between so that you could catch your breath. Very smart way to go and to ascend up towards Har HaBayit. On this road, we're finding all kinds of fascinating things. One of my favorite things that they found recently is this podium that you can see in the picture on the left. This was found a couple of years ago. And there are a number of suggestions what it was, right? One kind of depressing suggestion from Eyal Miron is that this is the place where the Romans would carry out public crucifixions and public executions. But I prefer the other explanation that we have here, which ties this to a place that we hear about in the Gemara, okay? Now think about it for a second. Thousands of Jews are coming on Aliyah LaRegel. There are lots and lots of people. And when there are lots and lots of people, things get lost. Children get lost. Think of the last time you went to an amusement park, right? And the announcements over the PA. Now, so-and-so, come pick up your child who's waiting at the front desk. So there's a lost and found. And that's what the Gemara in Bava Metzia talks about, right? When the Gemara talks about lost and found, Hashavat Aveda, it talks about a place in Jerusalem. The sages taught in a Braita, there was a claimant stone, Evan HaToen. Claimant stone in Jerusalem. Anyone who lost an item would be directed there, and anyone who found a lost item would be directed there. The finder would stand and proclaim his find, and the owner would stand and provide his distinguishing marks and take the item. And that is the place about which we learned in a Mishnah in Tani, go and see if the claimant stone has been obscured by the rising water, right? We have this great story in the Gemara in Tani about Choni HaMa'agel, who prays for rain, and there's too much rain, right? And the marker is, has the Evan HaToen been erased? So this is a great example of kind of a very lifelike, like really brings to life this experience of Aliyah LaRegel. And another example, I always think it's a sad example because it's happened to me many times, is this picture that you see on the right here of this beautiful earring. Okay? And the excavations that were done in the Givati parking lot, this, which is across from the official entrance to the city of David, this earring was found. There's not a woman I can guess on this Zoom right now who has not at one point lost a beloved earring. Okay? This happened 2,000 years ago. Somebody came on Aliyah LaRegel. Perhaps she got this earring as a gift for the holiday, and she lost it. She lost one, and we found it 2,000 years later. Once the dirt was cleaned off, it's actually beautiful because gold doesn't tarnish. Today, the city of David has made copies of it. You can buy it in the gift shop, but it's a great example of something very lifelike. These are people who are coming on Aliyah LaRegel. Right? Now let's understand the area around Har HaBayit. We're going to talk a little bit later about what was on the Temple Mount itself, what was in the temple. But for that, we really have very, very little archaeology. But the area around the Temple Mount, we have a ton of archaeology. Okay, and it's, there's a lot that we can learn about Aliyah LaRegel from it. And the reason we have a ton of archaeology is exactly what you're seeing in this picture. This is a photograph from 1909 of the area that we call the southern part of the Western Wall, as well as the Southern Wall. And none of it was touched. It's just a huge excavation site. And when excavations began, right, a little bit in the 19th century, most of it post 1967, it was a treasure trove of what the area around the Beit HaMikdash looked like. So this street, which I'm guessing a lot of people here have been to, this is the street that we call it the Southern Wall. It's not really the Southern Wall. It's the southern part of the Western Wall, right? You have the most northern part is the Kotel tunnels. Then you have the part where you go to pray. Then you have the egalitarian prayer part. And then you have this area, which we call Robinson's Arch. We'll get to Robinson's Arch in a minute. Okay. But this street, this main street, which somebody who guides in the Kotel tunnels calls it Wall Street, right? It's the street that runs along the wall, goes all the way from the southern part of the wall, all the way through the area of the Kotel tunnels. If you've ever done that tour, you know that this street continues, and it was all open to the sky, and you had stores all along the way on both sides. We'll talk about this depression in a minute, but this is just the pictures of the stores. What are you shopping for? You're shopping for all sorts of things. Your supplies for the time that you're in Jerusalem. You couldn't bring everything with you. as well as your korbanot, as well as spending your maser sheni money, right? Twice in the 7-year Shemitah cycle, we have something called maser sheni, where we have to bring a tenth of our produce to Jerusalem and enjoy it in Jerusalem. It's not that we give it to poor people like maser ani. We enjoy it in Jerusalem, but it's very nice if I have, you know, one pomegranate tree. I bring my 10 pomegranates. But what if I have an orchard of pomegranate trees? I'm not hauling a truckload of pomegranates to Jerusalem and eating them. I'm converting it into money. I'm bringing the money and I'm spending my money in Jerusalem. It helps the Jerusalem economy. It emphasizes that Jerusalem is the center for the Jewish people. And that's another thing you might be shopping for here. On this main street, we found all sorts of interesting things, right? In the picture on the left, you have stones that are for weight, right? Weighing stones, scale stones, right? Think about ancient scales. They have think about your old Rosh Hashanah cards, right? They have those two holders, right? And one holder, one dish, you put whatever you're buying, your bananas. And the other, you put a weight that weighs a quarter of a kilo, a half a kilo, a kilo. These are those weights, okay? And these weights are actually a very interesting, in the Torah, we have very specific instructions regarding these weights, right? You have to have fair weights because this is a very, very easy way to cheat. Okay. All you have to do, shave a little off your weight. And then every time somebody buys something, you earn a little bit of money. By the end of the week, you've earned a nice amount of money and nobody is the wiser. So the Torah says, Hashem is watching, Avnei Tzedek. You have to be careful about your weights. The Roman Empire didn't trust in people's belief in God. And they actually had an official whose job was to go around to the places in the market and check the weights. Okay. So we have these weights. We also have stone vessels that people use to measure out what they bought. We also have coins, and we also have this very lovely find over here on the right. Okay, and if you look at it carefully, you can see that this is a manhole cover. Okay, all you have to do is stick a pipe, piece of metal in between these two triangles, okay, underneath the triangles, pry it open, and that gets you down to the sewers. And we have very sophisticated sewers. We're in Roman times already, so there's a sewer, and there's a way to clean out the manholes, to clean out the sewers by going down through the manhole cover. So these are all things that were found on the main street. Something else that was found on the main street, which is a fascinating way of understanding the connection between the Mikdash and everyday life, is this stone. Okay, look at the picture on the bottom. This stone is a corner, right? You can see very nicely that it's a corner. The stone is still there, but in this top part of the stone is an inscription, which has been taken to the Israel Museum. This is a copy. And it has beautiful letters. You can read it really nicely. It's very nice, perfect Hebrew letters, the Ktav Ashuri that we use today, the square script. Lebet Hatkia Lehach Lehav. We don't know. It was cut off when it fell. What's a Bet Hatkia? Okay, so in the days before cell phones and digital clocks and alarms, how did you tell time? Okay. You told time with sundials, but who told time? Really, nobody cares about time. Most people don't care about time. Ancient world, the sun rises, you wake up, eat your breakfast, you go to work, the sun sets, you come home from work, and that's it. You eat your dinner, you go to bed. You don't need to ever be anywhere at 1:23 in the afternoon. Right? Nobody needs to know what time it is. The only people who need to know what time it is are the Kohanim and the Leviim who serve in the Mikdash, because Korbanot are connected to time, right? Think about Ben Harbaim, right? Think about our davening today is connected to time based on the Korbanot. So it's the job of the Levi to go up on the roof of the Mikdash, of Har HaBayit, the southwestern corner of Har HaBayit, to this place, the Beit HaTkia, and to blow a shofar. Okay, and Chazal tell us about this activity. The sages taught in a Braita, they sound 6 blasts on Shabbat Eve. The first blast is in order to stop the people from working the fields. The second blast is to stop those who are working in the city and inform the proprietors to close the stores. The third is to inform them to light the Shabbat lights. That is a statement of Rabbi Natan. Rabbi Yehuda Anasi says the third is to remove their phylacteries, their tefillin. He pauses after the third blast for the length of time it takes to fry a small fish or stick bread to the sides of the oven. And I think of that as that our 18 minutes. And he sounds a tekiah and a truah and a tekiah, and he accepts Shabbat. Okay, today this custom still holds in certain holy places like Jerusalem or Muncie or Borough Park. But the original custom comes from the Beit HaMikdash, and it's a beautiful connection between the Beit HaMikdash and everyday life. Okay, we mentioned that mikvaot are all around Har HaBayit. We have this phrase in the Gemara, Parts HaTzah Rabbi Yisrael. One of the things that in Bayit Sheni times becomes almost a religious obsession is Tara, Tuma and Tara, and who is Tahor, and when are they Tahor, and are you preparing your food in Tahara? And it becomes a way to distinguish people from each other, sort of in the way that Kashrut is kind of like a dividing line today. Tara was in those days. We have mikvaot all around Har HaBayit. Today, they're really discovering unbelievable corpuses, connections between mikvaot underneath in the Kotel tunnels, but also near this area of the main street that we're talking about. Here we see on the left this nice mikvah with a dividing line like we saw before, but this one is much smaller. On the right is a very interesting mikvah. This is a mikvah that you can see in the Kotel tunnels. If you look, you can see that it has just a very tiny place to immerse, right? Look at that. That's not big enough for even a very skinny person. So what is this? This we think is a mikvah kelim. Right, this is a mikvah for objects, because we know objects are also brought to the mikvah. Why make it so narrow and have these steps that go all the way down? So we have a very interesting halacha that talks about if you have very small objects, like needles, right? How do you immerse a needle? You need the whole thing to be immersed. You don't want to lose hold of it. You want to drop it. What are you going to do? So the Mishnah talks about how you put it on the stairs and you kind of lap the water over it. So we think that maybe that's what this is. This is a very sophisticated kind of a mikvah kelim. I finished all my preparations. I bought my korbanot. I've gone to the mikvah. I've seen all my friends. Now I want to go up on top of Har HaBayit. How do I get to the top? So there are a few ways to go up. We're going to see a drawing of how this looked in a minute, but this is an area called Robinson's Arch. Okay. On the right, you can see how it looks today. It's high up, about at least 10, 12 courses, rows of stones up from the original street. But in the picture on the left is a great picture, because this is how Robinson's Arch looked in the early 19th century. It looked like this up until basically 1990s, okay, 1980s. This is Robinson's Arch. Street level goes all the way up to the arch. And here's this gentleman sitting on what he thinks is a little bench with a nice little shade. The first person who figures out that this is not a nice little bench, but is actually part of something bigger, is a fellow named Robinson. Okay, there were no Robinsons in Bayit Sheni times. This is Edward Robinson. He was a priest from New England who came to the Holy Land in the early part of the 19th century. He's one of the earliest archaeologists, not a priest, a pastor. He was Protestant. And he's one of the first people to discover a lot of interesting things. He's fascinated by the Bible. He wants to find the truth of the Bible. And he's the first one who looks at this and says, aha, maybe this is part of something bigger. Maybe it's part of an arch of a bridge. Now, he thought it was a bridge that led across to what we call the Jewish Quarter today. It turns out was only partly right. It was a bridge, but it was a pedestrian bridge that was supported by the stores below. And this was the way that you would go up and into the Beit HaMikdash. You could do your shopping on that main street. Okay. And then you could go up and across and over into the Mikdash. And this was a very nice, easy way to enter the Mikdash. This is also a place where we have a very resounding example of the Churban, right? Because if you look at an arch is an engineering marvel. It's a brilliant idea. It's all held together by the keystone, right? The stones on either side push against this stone in the middle, and that holds it together. But conversely, you can get rid of it very easily by pulling out the keystone. And if we go back a couple of, oops, sorry, wrong direction. Go back a couple of pictures. Okay. This huge indentation in the ground is caused by that keystone being pulled out and the arch shattering and dropping to the ground, and it's still there today. So this was one way to go up into Har HaBayit. Another way to go up was through something called the Chulda gates. Okay, today these gates are really difficult to see them in the picture. In real life, it's a little bit easier. Okay, you have three closed up gates over here on the southern wall of the Temple Mount, and you have kind of a little bit of a piece of a gate, of a double gate, a little further in, which has been blocked by a building that was built many centuries later. Okay, but these were called Chulda gates. You had two sets of gates. We're going to see it in the picture in a minute. It'll look more clear. Okay, two sets of gates, one on the eastern side, right, and the right of the picture, one on the western side. And this was to make things easy for entrances and exits. Why are they called the Chulda gates? Okay, so some people suggest that the Nevi'ah, the prophetess Chulda, who's, of course, in First Temple times, she used to hang out here. None of this existed in the time of Chulda because this is all from late Second Temple times. But maybe she sat here and she prophesied here. Maybe. More likely, the reason they're called the Chulda gates is the same reason that none of you know any nice little girls named Chulda, right? Why don't we name little girls Chulda? Because a Chulda also means a mole or a rat. In modern Hebrew, it means a rat. And in Mishnah times, it seems it means either a mouse or a mole, something that tunnels underground. We don't really want to name anybody after that. But it fits very nicely because here, when you enter, you're actually tunneling underground. We've actually seen pictures of these hallways under Har HaBayit. And at some point, there's a staircase where you ascend to the Temple Mount. So you're a Chulda, you're a tunneler, you're a mole, right, who goes underneath the ground. Why the two sets? So here we get the Mishnah in Midot that gives us fascinating information. All who entered the Temple Mount entered by the right and went round to the right and went out by the left, right? You have thousands of people going up on Har HaBayit at the same time. We don't want to have a disaster. So we make sure that everybody goes in the entrance and goes out the exit. So there's no stampede. So what's the entrance? The entrance is over here on the east and the exit is over here on the west. Very nice. Except there are some people who have to go the other way, save for one to whom something had happened, who entered and went round to the left. Now, I want you to picture a crowd of Jews, okay, all of them going in one direction, and there's one guy who's elbowing his way, going the other way. What do all these helpful Jews say? What's the matter with you? Didn't you see the sign? Don't you know you're supposed to go in one direction? And he says, right, that he was asked, why do you go down to the left? He answered, because I am a mourner, right? Here's a very interesting example of a way that an avel, a mourner, goes out into public, right? But he has to show that he's a mourner. And then they have to say to him, may he who dwells in this house comfort you. Hashochein b'bayit hazeh yinachamecha. Now, think about that for a second. It's a very beautiful idea because chances are that the two people who have this encounter have never met and will never meet again, right? One might be coming from Babylonia. One might be coming from the Galilee. One might be coming from Alexandria. But we have the idea that in Yerushalayim, Ir Shechubra LaYachdav, it's a city that draws people together. And here, you have to comfort each other, whether you know each other or you don't know each other, because you're Jews. Here in the temple, we are all connected. We are all brothers. Anashim Achim Anachnu, right? The other answer is a little bit stranger, because I am excommunicated, right? I'm Minudeh in Hebrew, right? There's a form of excommunication called Nidui. What are you supposed to say to that, right? Oh, get away from me? No. May he who dwells in this house inspire them to draw you near again. The words of Rabbi Meir, right? Rabbi Meir, who is a great believer in pius, in helping people come together and join together. He says, I hope that God brings those chachamim to get rid of the nidoy. Rabbi Yossi said to him, you make it seem as if they treated him unjustly. Right? He did something wrong. He was punished. He should be punished. Rather, they should say, may he who dwells in this house inspire you to listen to the words of your colleagues so that they may draw you near again. I hope you do tshuva, right? Which is also a little bit shocking and beautiful, right? Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh LaZeh. We're connected to each other. We're responsible for each other. We have to tell each other how to behave. Maybe we don't do that so much today. Maybe that's not such a bad idea, but this is the idea in the Mishnah that we are supposed to connect to people and tell them the right way to behave. Okay, the Mikdash, every time we talk about the temple, and when you go to places like Machon HaMikdash, most of the time we are talking about Herod's temple because it's the one that we know the most about. Okay? We have the most literature about it. And that's very important because with very few exceptions, we have no archaeology for the temple. Okay, we have no archaeology for the temple, A, because it's been destroyed and built this whole area over and over again, and B, because to do an excavation on Har Habayit today would be impossible. And so what we know from the Mishnah and the Gemara and from Josephus and sometimes from the New Testament, and that's how we can draw our pictures that we have here. Okay? Mm-hmm. The Gemara emphasizes, right, if you have not seen Herod's building, you've never seen a beautiful building in your life, right, and describes it in marble and gold and shining in the sun and incredibly impressive and beautiful. Who is allowed up on the mountain? Okay, so let's go back to our former picture for a moment. The easy answer to that question is everyone. Everyone's allowed up on the mountain as long as they follow certain rules, right? Going to the mikvah, and nobody is allowed to go everywhere. Okay, there are restrictions on everyone. Okay, the strongest restriction is on non-Jews. Non-Jews are allowed to go up to this point. It's called the Sorag, yeah. And it goes all the way around. Okay, I can see it on the other side. And that's what this, sorry, that's what this picture, my marker went crazy. Okay, that's what this picture is about. This is an inscription that was discovered on the Temple Mount about 100 years ago. It's in Greek, as you might be able to see. And it says, if you go beyond this point, thanatos, that's the word at the bottom, death, okay, you will be put to death. Now, it's written in Greek because it's written for non-Jews. Non-Jews came to Har HaBayit. It was a spectacle, just like today. We go to see all kinds of amazing things around the world. Non-Jews came to see the Temple Mount, but they were not allowed to go beyond the Sorag, and that's what this instruction is telling them. And now, was there actually a guard standing there and checking your tzitzis, as it were, or was it something that was bidei shamayim? We don't know, but we do know that this sign was up there. Now, beyond that, let's just go back to this picture for a moment. Oh, actually, we'll go inside here. This is easier. Okay. Once you got past that, all Jews can go past the Sorag, and all Jews can come into what's called the Ezrat Nashim, the women's court. Okay. That's what you have here on the left side of the picture. This is so large because you have to have space for all these people. The only time you have a separation between men and women when they built a balcony was Simchat Beit HaShoevah, right? The rejoicing of the water drawing on Sukkot. It's the only time you have a separation between people. Otherwise, everybody's here together. This is where the Kohen reads the Torah on Yom Kippur. This is where the king reads the Torah on Hakel, right? The Sukkot after Shemitah. This is where the Levim stand on the Ma'alot and they sing their songs. You have chambers here where the Nizirim prepare to end their Nizirut, or where the Mitzoraim prepare, you know, to get ready to give their Korbanot, right? You have all kinds of things that are happening in preparation for the next section, okay? You have this narrow area called Ezrat Yisrael, where Israelites who are men, although there's a disagreement in the Gemara that says women can come in here too. But in any case, the only reason you come in here is to do smicha, is to put your hands on your korban. Okay, that's why it's very narrow, because you don't need a lot of people to come in here. Past that, you have the large area of the Azara. And at this point, only Kohanim and Levim, because this is the place of the Mizbeach, where you prepare the sacrifices, where you, butcher the meat, where you do all the things that are connected with the korbanot, not for the faint of heart. Okay. Past that, you have the Heichal. You have the actual Mikdash, where only Kohanim can go in. Kohanim can enter into the Kodesh. Okay. Past the Kodesh, Kodesh Kodashim, only the Kohen Gadol, only on Yom Kippur. Okay, so everybody at a certain point or at a certain time is closed off, right? No one can go everywhere at all times. And that, I think, is an important thing to understand about the Mikdash. And then, of course, you have all these other chambers all around. We will not go into them now, but one of them, of course, is the Lishkat HaKazit, the chamber of the Yun Stone, where the Sanhedrin would sit. So the Har HaBayit is not just a place of religion and connection to God and sacrifices and also social event. It's also a place of Torah learning. All right. We even have this beautiful Gemara that talks about how Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai before the Churban, he needed a place to teach Torah and the crowds were so large and it was very hot, right? Think about Jerusalem in the summertime. He needed a place that had enough shade for everyone. They would sit in the shade of the Heichal. Okay. Sitting on Har HaBayit in the shade so that he could teach Torah. Among the various things that were discovered around Har HaBayit was this fascinating little clay seal or chit, okay? You could see that it has writing on it. Okay? This is a great example of a connection to the Korbanot, okay? Depending on how you interpret it. And we're going to interpret it in two ways. So if you could see, it has nice Hebrew letters. And the Hebrew letters are Dalet, Chaf, Yud or Aleph. There's a disagreement, okay? Lamed, Yud, He. So the excavators who discovered it said, it says Decha, okay? Dechi, holy, or pure, excuse me, tahor, dechi is pure, liyah, pure to God. And this is a seal that was put on a jar of oil, a jar of wine, something that was going to be used in the Beit HaMikdash that we wanted to make sure it was pure. And that's one explanation. But really, the yud looks a little more like an aleph. And a different scholar named Shlomo Naor gave, I think, a fabulous different explanation. And he bases it on this Mishnah in Shkalim. Four seals in the temple, Arba'a Chotamot hayu b'mikdash, v'katuv aleim, and on them was inscribed, Egel, Zachar, Gedi, Chote, calf, ram, kid, sinner, right? Different kinds of korbanot. What would you do if you wanted to bring a korban? You didn't bring a korban from home. You brought money. You went to the proper lishka, the chamber. You gave your money and you got a seal, a chit, right? A receipt that said what you bought. And then that receipt was brought to the kohanim and you got your animal brought to them and that was your animal. And that was an easier way to streamline the whole process. Ben Azai says there were five and they were written in Aramaic. Egel, Zachar, Gedi, Chote, Dal, Chote, Ashir. Okay, but he doesn't write it in Aramaic. Okay, but the Bartanura, the explanation of the Mishnah says Zachar is for an ayil, shetargum eyal, dichra, dalet, chaf, resh, aleph. Okay, that's a male ram. Okay, so now what does Professor Naor say? He says this is a receipt and it says dalet, chaf, Dachar, right? This is the male. What's the Aleph? Aleph is the first day of the week, Yom Rishon. Lamid Yud He, Le Yehoyariv, to one of the Mishmarot Kuna, the Mishmeret of Yehoyariv. Why would you do that? Because let's say I went and I gave my money and I got my seal, my chit, right, for my korban, and I managed to get it at the end of the process. I got it back. And I gave it to my little brother who had to come to the mikdash tomorrow so he could save some money and he could give him the same chit. Because this is date stamped and nobody could give it in again. Right? It's a great example of the mikdash kind of on an everyday level. Okay. We're going to go through these quickly, A, because I think people know them, and B, because we're running out of time. In the Kodesh, we have three things, right? We have the menorah. Big question, how did the menorah look? We have, of course, the menorah of the Arch of Titus, which has a base that is a tiered base, like what you could see in the picture here on the right from Achon HaMikdash. But we also have representations of the menorah. One of the oldest ones is a graffiti that was found in the Jewish quarter that goes back to the time of the Mikdash, which shows our menorah with a triangular base, right? This is how the Rambam draws the menorah, and this is how we think the menorah looked. And the question is, did the Romans change the base on the Arch of Titus? Was the base changed over time, perhaps by Herod? We don't know, right? But it's an interesting question. But in the Kodesh, we have the menorah symbolizing light and wisdom. We have the Mizbeach HaKtoret, right? The incense altar, which symbolizes our connection to God. We have specialists who made the Ktoret, the Beit Avtinus, which are not always praised by the sages, who said that they were the only ones who knew how to do it, but they would take monopoly and they would charge a lot of money. In their defense, they claimed that they didn't want anyone else to know it because they didn't want the recipe to be used in pagan temples. And finally, we have the Shulchan for the Lechem HaPanim, symbolizing our Parnassah, symbolizing being able to make a living. And these are the three things that we have in the Kodesh, okay? Special bread that's put on once a week in the Kodesh Kodashim, in the Holy of Holies. In First Temple times, we have the Aron with the Kruvim. By the end of First Temple times, we no longer have an Aron. It's Nignaz. It's put away. Where is it today? I don't know. Ask Indiana Jones. He just came out with a new movie. Maybe he can tell you. But we don't know where it is. Right? We don't know where the Aron is. And already in Beit Sheni, it's very clear that they don't know where the Aron is. And they don't make a replacement because there's no point to a replacement. The only thing that's holy about the Aron is its contents, right? The Luchot and the Shivrei Luchot. Without that, the Aron is just a box. So in Second Temple times, we know that when the Kohen Gadol comes into the Kodesh Kodashim on Yom Kippur and he brings in the Ketoret, he puts the Machta on the Evan Hashtiyah, the foundation stone, which of course is the rock that is at the center of the dome of the rock. And that's what you see in the picture over here. So already in Second Temple times, there are things that are missing from the Mikdash. It's much more physically, materially fancy and beautiful and large, but it's less, it has certain elements, spiritual elements that are definitely missing. All right. Just one more thing about the Kohanim and the Mikdash, is the Kohen Gadol, right? And the Kohen Gadol, of course, has special garments. His garments are colorful, as opposed to the Kohen Hediot, who has very fine linen garments, but they're white. But the Kohen Gadol has color. Color in ancient times signifies wealth, signifies royalty. And in fact, we have non-Jewish writers, Roman writers, who talk about the Kohen Gadol as the king of the Jews, right? They're mistaken in thinking that he's the king because he's the one who's wearing these royal colors. He's also literally carrying the weight of Am Yisrael on his shoulders, on his breastplate, right? We have the names of the Shvatim. And he's carrying very heavy weights around with him all the time. But just one archaeological connection, okay, if you look at the Me'il, at the tunic of the Kohen Gadol, it has on the bottom pa'amon v'rimon, bells and pomegranates. And there are arguments about how did the pomegranates, what did they look like, but a bell is a bell. And in fact, in the excavations that were done under this main street by Robinson's Arch a few years ago, they actually found a small bell. And that's what you see here in the picture on the right. Is it a bell from the time of the Mikdash? Is it a bell? It's a bell from the time of the Mikdash. Is it a bell from the Kohen Gadol? That we don't know. Okay, and now we're going to head into the last part, and then I see I have lots of comments, that is about the end of this time period. So if we want to talk about the glory days of Beit Sheni, we also have to acknowledge that those glory days were glorious physically, but not necessarily glorious spiritually. And this is not something that modern scholarship has discovered. We have this all over the Gemara. And one of the fascinating paradoxes is that the halacha is so, so exacting and careful about something called mi'ilah, right? Stealing from the temple, using things from the temple unjustly. And yet we know that corruption was rampant in the very people who were supposed to be safeguarding the temple, the Kohanim. Kohanim who used their connections and used their ties to the great vault that is the Second Temple, because there's a lot of money there, both physically and potential to make money, right? If you have the contract to supply the oil to the Mikdash, to supply the wood to the Mikdash, right? They use their connections to make tons of money, and the corruption is just overarching. We all know the famous Gemara that says, why was the Second Temple destroyed? Because of Sinat Chinam. But this Tosefta in Menachot says it so much more sharply, after listing how there were certain families of Kohanim who would take all of the skins, right? They were supposed to divide up at the end of the day the skins of the Kohanim among all the skins of the sacrifices among all the Kohanim who worked in the Mikdash that day. But there were certain families who would just bring in thugs and would take them all. And after this long description, where finally we get to the point that the people don't don't even give their skins to the Kohanim anymore. They make them be hefker. They say, well, we're not giving them to you. We finally have the statement of Rabbi Yochanan ben Torta. Rabbi Yochanan ben Torta said, why was Shiloh destroyed? Because they treated holy offerings disgracefully. Why was the first temple of Jerusalem destroyed? Because of idolatry, sexual immorality, and spilling of blood. But we know that in the later one, right, in the second temple, they labored in Torah and were careful with tithes. So why were they exiled? Because they loved money and each one hated his fellow, right? Very, very sharp language. We have another very well-known Gemara in Pesachim that talks about different families, families of Kohanim, and how they misuse their power. And one of them is the Katros family. Oili mi beit Katros, oili mi kumusehem, right? The Katros family would use their pens. What does that mean? They would write. They would tell on people to the Romans, and thereby they would, you know, kind of sow fear, and people would be afraid of them, and they would do what they want. In the burnt house, in the Jewish quarter, we discovered a seal that says Dibar Katros. And lately, when they did excavations in the where they're rebuilding the Tiferet Israel synagogue right across from the burnt house, they found another one. So the Katros family definitely lived in the Jewish quarter. Besides this greed, we also had this idea of Parta Tara of Israel, this great desire for Tara, which could be a beautiful thing, except when the priorities became completely misplaced and when Tara became more important than anything else. And we have this horrific story that's told in a few different places, and here's the version in Yoma. An incident occurred where there were two priests who were equal as they were running and ascending the ramp. Everybody wanted to do what's called Trumat HaDeshah and clear away the ashes from the previous night's korbanot. And so they would race to the top to see who got there first. One of them reached the four cubits before his colleague, who out of anger took a knife and stabbed him in the heart. Okay, so first of all, this desire, great desire to do the avoda more than a desire to not kill somebody. The father of the boy, the young priest who was stabbed, came and found that he was convulsing. He said, may my son's death be an atonement for you. But my son is still convulsing and he has not yet died. As such, the knife in his body has not become ritually impure. Don't worry, it's okay. The knife is still tahor. Okay? The incident comes to teach you that the ritual purity of utensils was of more concern to them than the shedding of blood. Now, not everybody was like this, right? There's a part in the Gemara that I left out here. Rabbi Tzadok comes and he's crying. He says, where are we going to do the egla arufa, right? Where are we going? Are we going to do it in the azara? Or are we going to do it in the ear? Like, where are we going to atone for this murder? But other people, murder was not important. The Tara was important. There are many, many, many reasons why the Great Revolt breaks out. Some of them are external. People are angry about the rule of the Romans, the corruption of the Romans, the greed of the Romans, but many of them are internal, right? Socioeconomic differences, religious differences, sectarian battles, right? There's a picture of the caves where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. Pacifists versus those who would fight until the very end. And of course, we have the famous story in the Gemara in Gittin about the burning of the storehouses, that it was more important to the zealots to fight the Romans than to save people from starvation. And finally, the Romans enter the city, breach the walls, establish themselves in the Antonia Fortress, north of the Temple Mount, northwest of the Temple Mount, the fortress that Herod built to protect the Temple Mount. That's where Titus is. And we have the story in Josephus. I'm not going to read through the whole thing. You can read it. You have it all in your source sheets, where he talks about how Titus is in the Antonia and his idea is not to destroy the temple. Is this true? Is Josephus making this up? We don't know. But according to Josephus, Titus wants to keep the temple to show, look at how powerful the Jews were, and yet we were able to conquer them. But what happened? A Roman soldier is incited, throws a torch onto the Temple Mount, and at that point, nothing can stop them. The Roman soldiers pour onto the mountain, destroy the temple, hurl the stones down to the street. Everything is destroyed. A month later, they conquer the upper city. These are pictures from the burnt house of the destruction that was there, of the weapon that was found there, the bones that were found there, the ashes that were there. The entire temple is destroyed. The Romans take over in Jerusalem. We find traces of them in their roof tiles that are stamped Legio X, the 10th Legion, the ones who conquer the city, in their weapons that have been found, this sword that was found under the main street of the city, a theater that they built, under what is today the Kotel tunnels, but then was just part of the street that the Romans wanted to have a theater. And of course, in Rome, where they bring the spoils, the Arch of Titus showed carrying the menorah and the other spoils from the temple, and of course, the money and the Jewish slaves that are used to build the Colosseum. And this terrible, terrible end, we have to finish with something a little bit hopeful, because here we are at the end of Tisha B'Av, at least here, and we need some hope. And that, of course, is the story of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, who sees what's going on, who understands that he needs to do something. And so he sneaks out of the city. He asks the Roman general Vespasian for Yavne, right? Yavne, this little town in the middle of nowhere near the coast, because Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai understands that we may not need, we may be able to survive without a land. We may be able to survive without a temple, difficult as that is, but we cannot survive without our teachers and our leaders and our Torah. And that's what he does. And he saves Torah by going to Yavne. But in Yavne, we also have to come up with a way to remember, but not to be consumed by memory. Okay? And that's why we have this Gemara in Bava Batra, where Rabbi Yoshua is trying to deal with people who are so deeply in mourning that they don't want to eat or drink anything. And finally, he says to them, look at the last paragraph. Rabbi Yoshua said to them, my children, come and I will tell you how we should act. To not mourn at all is impossible, as the decree was already issued. But to mourn excessively is also impossible, as the sages do not issue a decree upon the public unless a majority of the public is able to abide by it. And the rabbis come up with ways to remember, whether it's writing on the wall, shachor al lavan zecher lachorban, breaking a glass at a wedding, sitting on the floor on Tisha B'Av, keeping the memory of Jerusalem alive in every synagogue throughout the diaspora. And that memory is so strong that ultimately we are able to return and to rebuild. So I'm going to stop the sharing. I'm going to look quickly at the questions in the chat. Oh boy. Rabbi Kelman, you tell me when I have to stop. All right.
Okay. You have about 118 seconds or so.
Okay. All right. If you're more than 15 mil away from Azara, you have to, you're considered too far. Okay. That's a lot of work to do. Fine. Yes. Okay. Sources, were women required to do the Allah la regal or just the men? That's a very interesting question. It says that women have the commandment, but the men have the commandment, but the women are coming to hear and the children are coming to learn, right? But yes, kol zachar. But you also have to have picture holidays, right? This is not the breast lovers at Uman. We're not leaving the women and children at home. People are coming. Everyone's coming, right? You have to do that. Okay, lost earrings, no excavations on the Temple Mount. Yes, religious and political. Hebrew script is being used in the time of Beit Sheni, right? We talk about Ezra. All right, Ezra brings the Ketav Ashuri. I'm not going into all the writing, right? The bones in the grass, that's a very, very interesting. It's not in the old alphabet. It's in our alphabet, and it's from Roman times, possibly, although we don't know. Okay, I'm not going into all the alphabet. We have a whole PowerPoint about that, Rabbi Kelman. We'll do it at a different point in time. Okay, what point required tefillah in a mikvah for Jews? I assume already as you begin to ascend, that would be what would make sense to me. But I don't know if that's discussed anywhere. Where were the animals kept waiting to be sacrificed? There were places on Harabait for all of those different things, right? You did not have, and I think they come in from the backside, if I'm remembering correctly. Okay, source sheets, yes. I spent 6 months on Kibbutz Yavne. Okay, thank you. I think I answered most questions.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, Shuli, go relax. You got another hour and then you can go eat. Okay, that's
everyone should have a tzom kal, and we should meet next year in Yerushalayim.
Amen. Shuli,
Amen.
Want to thank you again
thank
for
you.
always wonderful to have Amen. You and really
thank you.
Look forward
Rabbi,
to that.
There's an hour and 9 minutes, but who's counting? And
we'll take a 2 minute, 2 minutes, 11 second break. And
thank
Rabbi
you, Shuli.
Vitek,
we'll, thank you, Shuli.
Right, Rabbi?
Thank you, Shuli.
Thank you, thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye, Shuli.